It's Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North.
I'm Mitch Tyke. For decades, LGBT culture was, out of necessity, hidden and unspoken of in daylight. But three quarters of a century has brought lots of social change in America.
For a smaller industrial city with German roots, you may not have expected Milwaukee to be a spot for gay and lesbian culture to thrive. But it did. More than 35 gay bars and gathering places existed in Milwaukee, even before the Stonewall riots put the gay community and culture into the national spotlight. These places range from hidden hotel spaces to back rooms of the 60s to classic Milwaukee taverns and clubs that exist today.
Michael Takash set out to bring the little-known history of LGBT bars to light in a book that showcases photos and stories of the city's hidden past. The book is called LGBT Milwaukee, Images of Modern America. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of a Boswell book event tonight and explained what prompted him to take this project on.
I lived in the Fifth Ward for 10 years, and in that time frame, I watched as many legacy bars, gathering places, and even the people who gathered there started to disappear from the Milwaukee landscape. And, you know, with all of the progress that the LGBTQ communities have made in America during that same time, it was kind of a sad trade-off and not a fair one at that. So in partnership with the Wisconsin LGBT History Project, which was started by Don Schwamm in 2003 and had its roots in a Pride Fest history exhibit that started in 1994, we took an outline that had already been established of notable people, places, and events, and I began the work of filling in the what and the why. We knew the where, we knew the when, we knew the how. We just didn't really know the what and the why, and those stories are at great risk of becoming hidden history, if not lost history, as those people are, you know, leaving us.
And what do bars function for as the LGBT community? Throughout time, this documents, you know, from what was known from the first bars up to leading to what it still exists today.
Right. In Milwaukee, being a very tavern town, bars have traditionally served a purpose as a community center, a gathering place, a place to meet people and know people like yourself with similar interests, and in a safe place, especially for the LGBTQ community, that, you know, you can be whoever you want to be and do whatever you want to do without fear of being thrown out, of being arrested, of being brutalized. And, you know, in the early days of our gay history in Milwaukee, bars were really the only place people could do that, aside from locked rooms, either locked rooms in their home, locked rooms in hotels. There really were not a lot of places where people could gather because laws prohibited business owners from allowing gay people together. I mean, they could literally lose their license, they could be shut down, and many places were. So the idea that there would be safe places for gay men and women to gather in those days was somewhat unthinkable in Milwaukee, but at the same time, it's unthinkable that there were so many of them. Prior to the Stonewall riots, which most LGBTQ history starts with, if you believe the research that's been done, prior to 1969, there were almost three dozen known gay bars in Milwaukee. And it's because people needed this sense of space. They needed somewhere to be themselves and see themselves reflected in the world. And at that time, they weren't seeing it anywhere but these bars.
And as I was reading through this, I honestly got a little sad because even though what is in here is just a fraction, you know, of what could have been collected, and the nature of these bars was hidden away, was secretive, was very much an inside knowledge of where to go and where to know where to go, where, as you say, it's a safe place. But that also meant there's not a lot of pictures. A lot of these buildings are torn down. Parking structures were put over some of these places, and not a lot of primary documents existed. So what kind of research went into this, and how did it make you feel when you were doing this?
I felt a lot like a detective, if not an archaeologist, although we're telling the history of post-war America here and even slightly before that, there isn't a lot documented. As you said, there's not a lot of artifacts. There's not a lot of memorabilia. If someone had, you know, collected a treasure chest of their memories, it was lost as soon as they passed away. Their families didn't know what to do with it. There wasn't an archive at that time where it could be donated to. In some cases, if families were disapproving or not welcoming of their loved one's life, They would just destroy it out of shame. And unfortunately, with that happening, this history was being erased. And it's really kind of tragic because there's so many factors here that work against this book ever existing. I mean, it's actually kind of shocking that we were able to pull this together, because you do have the fact that most of these historic gay and lesbian gathering places existed in in-between spaces. They were in places where no one would either think to look for them or in places where no one would really go unless they were looking for them. So with that in mind, no one was taking pictures of them. No one was documenting remodels or, you know, grand openings. No one was in there with cameras because a camera was a very dangerous thing to bring to a gay bar in those days. Anyone who saw a photo of someone at a gay bar could use it as blackmail. It wasn't just the person taking the photo. It was like someone finding this photo. So you had not only, you know, all of these risks, but then at the same time, you had the fact that these were not long-term spaces. Many of these bars came and went so fast that, you know, through word-of-mouth marketing, by the time you heard about them, they could have already closed. So it's almost impossible for us to think today, like, what it was like not only to, you know, live this life in an earlier time, but also to try to navigate this world in an earlier time. There wasn't obviously no internet. There were no guidebooks before 1963. The only way to know where these places were is to know someone who was like-minded and to follow them to this place. I spoke to someone who said that, you know, when they were growing up in the 1940s, they would literally go to the train or bus station in downtown Milwaukee and see someone who looked like themselves and just kind of had a radar effect and follow them out and follow them to where they were going. And that's how they discovered where the bars were. And that's really kind of a strange thought today, that you could just follow someone to where they were going. Today that might be seen as stalking. But back then it was kind of a navigation device. What is also fascinating is that because these bars existed in between spaces that no one really thought to go to, they were really in long forgotten parts of town, places that were designated for freeway construction, urban renewal, land clearance. I mean, these places popped up not by accident in spaces that no one wanted. And because of that, they're long gone now. I mean, you know, 794 eliminated what was really the first gay bar strip, if you will, which existed in the 1960s until the freeway opened and St. Paul Avenue was extended across the river. But prior to that, they were scattered all over the entire city in places that, you know, are unthinkable today. I don't know many people who would think to find a gay bar on 12th and Vine or on 19th and North or on Capitol and Green Bay Road. The fact that these were so scattered and were so predominant is both fascinating and kind of, even after my research, unexplainable. It speaks to the bravery of local business owners in taking a risk to serve a community that was not favored and was not protected, but needed a place to call their own.
Well, and going into those business owners who took this risk, a lot of these bars were affiliated with local mafia, or they paid off policemen or served policemen and their wives free unlimited drinks. A lot of quid pro quo happening kind of under the radar of official business so that they could stay open. And yet there was a lot of police raids, a lot of payoffs, and a lot of these places were torn down by arson, by fires. So do you see this as not necessarily a stain on their history, but just kind of another interesting aspect that the mafia was the willing group to see the potential and how lucrative it can be to serve this community?
Yeah, so it is interesting. After certain laws went into effect in the early 1960s that prohibited the B-girl trade, which is basically, you know, women in bars who were hustling men for drinks that were not really drinks and, you know, bringing in business that wasn't really business. When that law went into effect and strip clubs also went through a similar crackdown, the crime syndicates of America looked for new ways to raise revenue. And clearly, no one expected them to be in the gay bar business. It seems like so diametrically opposed to our stereotypical perceptions of what the mafia looked like. But honestly, their investment in this culture really made them the steward and guardian of a whole heritage that exists today because they made that business choice. So it's really an amoral position that I have on this because, you know, if they hadn't made this investment, we wouldn't be here as we are today. And because they did make this investment, we have this history to share and tell today. And I think that that's really fascinating because their marketing was brilliant, their business strategy was brilliant, and they really moved the needle on what nightlife looked like to the point where it was a very different Milwaukee because of their investment than before.
So in putting together this book, obviously you had a lot of images to sort through and include, but on the cover, there's not a typical rainbow pride flag. Why did you make this decision?
So in preparing this book, I recognized that although the past looked one way, the future looks a very different way. And as our community continues to rapidly and incredibly diversify, it's important to show that images of modern America, you know, the words that appear on the cover, are actually reflected here. We wanted an iconic image of Milwaukee that looked and felt Milwaukee, and the Allen Bradley Clock Tower does a great job, and some of the buildings in the background of the image really present the landscape that most people think of when they think of, you know, LGBT spaces in Milwaukee. But we didn't want it to look like any other city in America. We didn't want it to just be a pride flag, because although the pride flag includes a rainbow, we're really dealing with the spectrum, and the spectrum just keeps getting wider. So, you know, as you look at the photos, not only in the book, but on the front cover, the back cover, and in related press, we really wanted to reflect as much of Milwaukee's story as we could in 96 pages, recognizing that we could not tell everyone's story. We still needed to be reflective of as many people as possible. And I think that, you know, in looking at the cover, it says resilience, it says rugged, it says non-stereotypical, and I think that stereotypes are something that we need to overcome, you know, worldwide. But stereotypes in Milwaukee have always been very damaging, and I think it's important to show the real Milwaukee that exists here today for all people.
And one of the bars that has stood the test of relative time, like you said, many of these bars maybe had a couple or three-year lifespan, but this is it, just located a few blocks from us here, is the longest operating gay bar in Wisconsin. So how has it remained resilient?
Well, going back to the heart of this entire project, when June Brehm started the bar in 1968, she wanted to create a place for her gay friends to feel safe, to feel special, and to have as good an experience as anyone else in their nightlife choices. And at that time, there really were not a lot of nice bars for gay men to gather. We were still in a bust-out era. You were looking at warehouses or old taverns where the windows had been covered up. There was just one little teeny tiny window where people could see in. The lights were often so low in gay bars, you couldn't even see the person sitting next to you. Police reports from the 1960s show that when they raided some of these bars, the light was less than a candle's intensity. So, I mean, it really was not the best experience. So looking at that and knowing that she had friends who deserved better, June went forth to create a sense of space. And over the course of time, she and her son Joe really did a tremendous job of staying very connected to a community that was aging, a community that was suffering great losses, a community that was transforming, you know, as the world continued to mainstream gay culture and gentrify downtown into a place where people wanted to be instead of a place people were fleeing. They just did a really remarkable job of creating a place that at its heart felt like home. And today, their legacy continues. I mean, the bar is approaching its fifth decade. It'll actually celebrate its 50th anniversary in 2018, stronger than ever. And it's because of that strong connection to community. And I think that that's telling because much like in the original days of LGBT Milwaukee, today, you can't just throw a rainbow flag on something and appeal to the LGBT demographic. It just doesn't work. LGBTQ people are increasingly skeptical of how they're being courted by marketers, business owners, etc. So they really have to feel that, you know, their connection adds value. It has some sense of meaning. And This Is It has done a really good job of creating a sense of meaning that's multi-generational. I mean, the original patrons of that bar, two generations later, you know, the patrons are still having that same great experience.
Why is it important to have this book and these places documented? Do you see the Milwaukee LGBT community keeping its heritage and adding to this and keeping this in mind as it shapes into the future?
The transformation of the Fifth Ward and Walker's Point, as well as all of Milwaukee in recent years, really speaks to the risk of this hidden history being lost. When I first arrived on this scene, I gave no thought to what came before. I had no idea that this playground had not always existed and that the world had not always operated this way. And I think that that's common. I don't think that, unfortunately, LGBTQ people expect to have a heritage. They expect to be part of something, but it's always a forward-looking something. It's not really a past. And by knowing this history and heritage and connecting with a sense of past and understanding that we've always been here, this is not something that just happened. This is not a place in time that's new, but something that is accumulated. I think that people will have a much greater sense of pride, not only in their community, but also in Milwaukee for fostering this community for so many years. I think it's really important that younger people feel that there's something out there that reflects them. When I started this project, I worked with the Scrapbooks of Eldon Murray, who worked long and hard to document gay history at a time when no one wanted to talk about it, and he was not supported by educators, librarians, archivists, the way that I was supported on this project today. And in looking through his scrapbooks, I could feel, I mean, it was truly palpable, I could feel his need to find something in the world to help define himself and understand who he was and the world that he wanted to be part of. And sadly, I think that LGBTQ youth today are still having that same feeling. They want to connect to something. They want to find themselves in the world so that they know that they're okay. They're, you know, not abnormal. They're not the sexual deviates of 1960s newspaper terminology. And I think that a book like this goes a long way into showing people that, you know, people like you have always been here and will always be here. And you should be proud of that and be happy to join that heritage and make your own story.
Well, Michael, it really is a great look into what came before us and what still remains today. So I'd like to thank you for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you.
Michael Takash is the author of LGBT Milwaukee, Images of Modern America. The book was released this week, and Takash will talk about his work tonight at Boswell Book Company. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski.